A Sacramento museum is embroiled in a dispute over keffiyehs, an Arab headdress that can have cultural significance to Palestinians, especially when the fabric is black and white. Ahead on Insight, we'll have more background on the allegations against the Museum of Science and Curiosity, or MOSAC. Also, California is one of the top wine producers in the world, but the industry is facing some hard realities. Our resident wine expert, Rick Cushman, joins us with more on the why and what can be done. He'll also explain why spring is the best time to show tasting rooms a little love. Finally, a Central Valley celebration of cartoonists, artists, creators is returning to Modesto this weekend. We'll preview the Latinx Comic Arts Festival. It kicks off on Friday and runs through Saturday. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Inside. First, here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The conflict between Israel and Hamas is very difficult to talk about and even report on. We've received a lot of feedback about our coverage here at CAP Radio, on Insight and on NPR, and we appreciate all of it. Understandably, there is a lot of pain and emotions involved, and sensitivities are at a peak high. And that is deeply felt here in Sacramento. There have been heated protests and disagreements in the months following Hamas's deadly attacks and kidnappings in Israel on October 7th. And just yesterday, we had Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who is Jewish, and Palestinian community activist Bassem El-Kara on Insight to explain the city's ceasefire resolution, which was a tense and raw conversation given the escalating death toll and humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Today, we're going to better understand a dispute at Sacramento's Museum of Science and Curiosity, or MOSAC. Some employees are taking issue with the way museum leadership has been treating them for wearing keffiyehs, an Arab headdress that does have cultural significance to Palestinians, especially when the fabric is black and white. CAP Radio's Kate Wolf joins us with the backstory. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Vicki.
Okay, so first, let's just start off with MOSAC, the Museum of Science and Curiosity. For anyone who isn't familiar with it, what is it?
So MOSAC opened in 2021. It's a science center with exhibits and a planetarium. It was a private-public partnership that brought it about with the city, the county, SMUD. But the museum operates independently from them at this point. It's just north of Old Sacramento and has about 50 or so employees, a lot of part-timers, too.
Yep, right along the river.
Exactly.
So this all started because we caught wind of something that was happening at the museum, and it all came from a social media post on Instagram. So pick up the story from there. Who posted this?
So this was posted by the Change the Museum Instagram account. It's an account that was started in 2020 that's been sharing stories from across the U.S., highlighting stories, anonymous stories of inappropriate behavior. Their mission in their bio is to, quote, move beyond lip service proclamations by amplifying tales of unchecked racism, end quote.
And did the post say anything? Or no, it clearly did. But what did it say about the museum here in Sacramento?
So the post told the story of a string of incidents that happened at MOSAC, which I was told started in January of this year. So an Arab staff member wore a keffiyeh to work and was told to reconsider that choice. The next week, a few other staff members wore keffiyehs in solidarity with that initial person and were apparently pulled in by leadership to discuss that choice as well. Soon after, the museum came up with a policy banning, quote, clothing, apparel, or other visible symbols that make a political statement. So staff asked about, what about my pride pin? What about my I stand with Ukraine pin? They were told those would still be allowed, but anything having to do with the Hamas-Israel war wouldn't be.
What has the reaction been online?
There was a lot of displeasure. That's kind of why it came across our feed. A lot of people were upset. Thousands liked the post. Many tagged the company with their complaints. People said this seems like biased and inappropriate targeting of Palestinian people, Arab people, people who wear keffiyehs. MOSAC turned off their comments on their Instagram account after people went over to their account to complain about the treatment of the employee. So there was a lot of reaction online.
And this all stemmed from an Instagram post on social media. I mean, it's one thing to do this online, and then there is our job to verify what's being said, what is being written. So let's start there and dig into that. Can you walk us through who you spoke to and what they had to say?
I reached out to a lot of Mossack employees on LinkedIn. I did not hear from anyone. So I put a comment on the Instagram account, on the Instagram post, asking people to reach out to speak with me off the record. And I had a few people who were employees at the time of the incident who want to be identified that way, who verified the story and provided additional details. Only one of those people authorized me to quote them without attribution to them, but quoting them as an anonymous employee.
Okay, so they want to stay anonymous, but how do you go about verifying that they were actually employed by Mossack during that time?
Yeah, so I had them show me name tags and entry badges that verified who they were and that they worked at Mossack, and they also shared internal documents that only employees would have access to.
So what does the museum have to say?
So they issued a statement last week, and they didn't refute anything that was said in the post. They stuck broad. They said Mossack's highest priority is to maintain a safe and respectful environment where employees and guests can engage in science, learning, and fun. They don't tolerate discrimination of any kind and evaluate and update their policies regularly to ensure the museum is inclusive and welcoming for all. I did ask them again yesterday whether they had an updated comment, and they addressed the post. They said they are deeply saddened to see anonymous and unfounded allegations on social media about perceived discrimination, but again, they didn't refute anything specifically in the story.
There was also another development that happened with the Museum of Science and Curiosity. I mean, there was recently a decision to unionize. What do you know about that?
Last Thursday, 87% of a proposed bargaining unit voted to join the Communication Workers of America. So it was a big union win for the staff at Mossack.
Okay, so that was last Thursday, but the Instagram post was a few days before that. So did this have an impact on the vote to unionize, or were there other issues?
When I spoke to the employees, they shared that this effort predated the CAFIA situation. So one employee that I spoke to said, quote, "The issues in how staff and finances and relationships have been managed at the museum have been poor for a very long time." They are hoping that the union effort spurs significant change. It's certainly possible that the CAFIA incident and that attention, had the vote be more positively to join the union. But I asked Mossack for comment about the unionization effort, and they did not respond.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio's Kate Wolf about a controversy over a headdress known as a keffiyeh. It was worn by some employees at the Museum of Science and Curiosity in Sacramento, and it has become synonymous with Palestinians, especially when the fabric is black and white. So let's unpack some more context on this issue, because as we mentioned at the top, this is understandably a highly sensitive and a charged issue. So we're talking about an article of clothing, a headscarf, and that can be meaningful for people in a lot of ways. What did you learn about that?
The keffiyeh has become a strong symbol of solidarity with Palestinian people amid the bombardment of Gaza. Dr. Sahar Razavi is the director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State, and she broke it down for me.
The keffiyeh is a very important cultural symbol. The two main patterns are fishing nets, which are extremely important culturally and historically for Palestine and Palestinians, and olive leaves and branches, right? So it is not an inherently political symbol, although some Palestinians who happen to also be political leaders have worn it, but that wasn't because they were political, it's because they were Palestinian.
She said she was troubled by Mossack politicizing the keffiyeh. She says that she sees this as a part of a trend of the simple fact of people being Palestinian being seen as a political action.
Mm. You also spoke with a DEI expert. DEI is diversity, equity, and inclusion. What did they have to say?
I got some great insight from Sacramento-based Dr. Camille Broussard-Wise. She said she was really alarmed by Mossack making decisions of where to apply their policy on a case-by-case basis.
I don't see the logic, and I don't see that as a very wise choice to pick just one thing that we're not going to talk about. You just open yourself up for the appearance, at least, of impropriety or of bias.
She said this stuff is very subjective and so much can be heated and political. She pointed out that allowing a pride flag, a rainbow flag, it's something that we might see as innocuous, but it isn't.
That looks like a sanitized inclusionary symbol, and it is and should be also behind that represents lots of struggle that currently happens right now that is not sanitized.
So she says it kind of has to be an all or nothing approach if you implement a policy like this.
And so that's when going back to your initial examples, when you were talking to employees, like they could have a pride pin or even, for example, an I Stand With Ukraine pin. And according to them, that would be allowed at the museum.
Right, exactly.
Mm. So we don't know, obviously, how this will end or how it's going to play out. This is still very much fluid and in development. But big picture, are there some lessons on both sides that or all sides that can be drawn from this?
I think Wise had a great point when she said she assumes everyone is trying their best, employees, staff members, leadership, and that leadership in these moments is hard and lonely. But these policies need to be thought through. She says she thinks and hopes that this will cause regional organizations to look at their policies and decide proactively and not reactively what they're going to do. When she and Professor Razavi both make the point that when you try to regulate political expression in your workplace, it's murky waters because, as the saying goes, everything is political.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of nuance to it. It's one thing to wear a T-shirt or have a hat that supports a candidate. It's another thing to, have an article of clothing that can mean a lot of things depending on the context of, why the person's wearing it.
Exactly.
Hmm. So what happens next?
So we'll be looking out. The Sacramento chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, told me that they've received a civil rights complaint from one of the affected employees. So we'll see if that spurs any form of legal action. Meanwhile, the newly formed union will be bargaining for their first contract.
Hmm. Do you know anything more about the civil rights complaint and what that could entail?
I don't. I asked CARE for more details and to kind of give me some insight as to what could be next, and they were hesitant to speak on the issue. So,
and Kate, you've been working on this story for many days now. I mean, this original post was, nearly 2 weeks ago. It was Monday, I believe, March 11th. So for transparency and fairness, I mean, as you're working to put all these pieces together, get a really clear journalistic picture of what was unfolding, you did offer the Museum of Science and Curiosity, MOSAC, the representatives to speak with you, to come on Inside even today. And what did they say?
They declined an on-the-record interview. They did send me the follow-up statement I mentioned, sharing that they update these policies regularly to ensure that the museum is inclusive and welcoming for all. So we might see a policy update. I mean, it sounds too like this policy was made a little bit in the heat of the moment. It sounds like it was reactionary to the keffiyehs that were worn. So nothing is set in stone there.
In the posting, did you get a better idea of, because the allegations stem from someone in leadership not liking the keffiyeh. Do you get a better understanding of why they didn't like it?
So, yes, the employees that I spoke to mentioned that it was told that an Israeli director at Mossack was uncomfortable with this. And the Post also says that. So, I have not talked to leadership besides, the representative that Mossack shared with me. But that is where kind of that came from, is that apparently someone was wearing a keffiyeh, an Israeli director was uncomfortable with that, and it sort of snowballed from there.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about this because we've had a lot of conversations about how Sacramento is being impacted over, I mean, we have a very diverse community, a large refugee community. As I mentioned, we just had the mayor as well as a Palestinian community activist on about Sacramento's ceasefire resolution. There have been protests for weeks. There has been a lot of divisiveness, a lot of heated disagreements and protests. And this seems like here in Sacramento, what we're talking about is focusing on one museum. But this is kind of the latest of really difficult, complex conversations that are taking place in our city.
Definitely. And I think Professor Razavi also mentions, when you have an issue that's so heated, everyone in the diaspora feels it in an extremely intense way. And this is a way, the keffiyeh and the symbolism of the keffiyeh is a way that it's manifesting, I think, in local communities and manifesting in, in your classroom, in your workplace, right? So I was drawn to this story because I think it's just a really compelling example of how this conflict can affect people every day and how we navigate that.
Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Kate Wolf is Cap Radio's reporter here. And also you can read Kate Wolf's reporting in addition to our conversation that we just had on Insight. It is in the Sacramento newsletter. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, you can sign up for it at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California is one of the top wine producers in the world, rivaling France, Italy, and Spain. But the industry and the wine culture is facing a confluence of hard realities. Younger generations, 21 and over, aren't turning to wine like their elders. Inflation isn't really helping much. Production-wise, there's an overabundance of grapevines. Plus, there is also some competition from the cannabis industry. Our resident wine expert, Rick Cushman, joins us with more on the why and what can be done, as well as why we're rounding the corner to the best time to show tasting rooms a little love. Nice to see you, Rick.
Hey there, Ricky.
Good afternoon. Okay, so in preparing for our conversation, you led with a pretty provocative question. What is wine's future if no one is drinking it anymore? Are we approaching a wine apocalypse?
Well, not exactly, but then for some folks, maybe. And what it is, of course, in reality, lots of people drink lots of wine, but not to the levels that they used to. It's down, I think the numbers last year were like 7%. And, you know, the entire alcohol industry was down. In fact, there are people who called it the worst year since, I think it was 1991. And that's one of the impacts, is that, you know, there's a low alcohol, no alcohol changes. So some of that is affecting it. Some of it, as you said, was inflation. And wine's not cheap. You know, your choice when you go into a bar or restaurant is and get a beer versus a wine. Wine's double the cost. So there's all of that going on. And then younger folks drinking all kinds of things. And the only category, the only thing that is going up is the ready-to-drink cocktails, which tells you something, which is a lot of people drinking whatever they're drinking at home, not going out because going out's not cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a glass of wine now, you know, it can be, you know, $15, $17. You don't even know if you like it.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the problem, too. And that is, you know, one of wine's great problems is its size and complexity. And I was thinking of that when I was making my long drive over here of about 5 minutes, you know, that I don't know that much about beer, but I know I can go to a place like near us, Lefty's around the corner there on Elvis, and there's this large list of beers, many of which I don't know, but the simple descriptions, porter, lager, you know, IPA, gives you some hint. But for the rest of, you know, for wine, it's a Tempranillo, it's a Grenache Blanc, it's a Gamay. We don't even know where to start. People don't even know if Gamay is red or white, and you know a lot of people don't. And so, it's just a gigantic industry to begin with that makes it so complicated for everybody. And then at that point, you know, people start saying, "I'll go the easy route."
So you mentioned that ready-made drinks, you know, they're faring a little better, but are people actually drinking less? I mean, I know during the pandemic, the height of staying at home, drinking went up.
Yes.
So is it going back down now?
Yes. Well, this is another complicated thing. So in part, yes. In part, some of the numbers are a little bit overblown because they're compared to COVID when we were buying giant caches of alcohol to do something. But you know, WHO came out with a recommendation that all alcohol is bad for you, and there's lots of scientists that say this is wrong and they overstated it. And there's people lobbying for their own reasons that alcohol is bad, and there's a lot of studies that basically say a little bit of drinking or moderate drinking, people live longer. But then there are lifestyle studies, and there's so much involved in those, so I'm not weighing in on that one. But the answer is that younger folks tend to drink less, and cost is one of the reasons, and then just alcohol is another. But overall, there is a little bit less alcohol being consumed across the world, but in the U.S. in particular.
I mean, I think about the ads that I see online, for people who are sober curious or right. want an alternative, like adaptogens is this popular word now. And this also comes at a time in recent years where recreational marijuana is legal. So is that kind of poaching some alcohol drinkers?
Yes, absolutely. And, like with everything else, you always have to sort of look behind the curtain, anybody who's, and part of all of these industries are, somebody's trying to make a lot of money out of it. And so you sell an idea that is either solves all your problems or somebody else has a lot of problems. And so the anti-alcohol movement has been very good at that. And then the cannabis industry has been very low key, and it doesn't need to be because people are curious. They're curious. And, it's become easier to get. And it feels like it's now completely, especially if it's you're not smoking, a completely a healthy thing to do. Whether it is or is not, we don't actually know. Is it worse than wine or alcohol? We have no idea.
Yeah, maybe people like it because if they wake up with a headache the next day after drinking a little too much.
And then there's that.
Yeah, of course, which is not
which
a
neither
a
you or
thing.
I have ever had happen.
Of course not. Yeah. Never. Never. Ever. Ever. Given that now you mentioned inflation, I mean, the cost of wine, has always been, it's been at a higher price point. Does this also mean...
And going up, by the way.
And going up. Yeah. So is there also a culture shift in how people view wine?
Yes.
And it's a turnoff?
Well, that's... Yes. So price is part of it. So one of the things, and this is... ever since I've been, sitting in one of these chairs here in the Insight studio talking about wine, this has been one of the things that I've been complaining about, which is that wine sells itself, it sells its elitism. And I think that's a really bad thing because it shouldn't be elite. It should be fun and joyful. But it has been an attraction, and we know enough people, probably everybody who's listening probably knows enough people who thinks they're really cool because they can afford an expensive wine or they have a lot of wine or whatever it is. And wine has been that way, and that's another whole segment of how it got there. But there has been a general reaction against that in the world, and especially among younger people, and good for them. So this elitism that they're selling, the sense of complexity, and it is complex, is not ringing any bells for many, many consumers. And so it's like, back to what we were saying earlier, why am I going to put myself through it? I've had conversations with wine people who say, we just need to educate our consumers. And I say, isn't that a bad business model that they have to get educated before they can buy your product? That seems exactly backwards. How about you listen to them and give them what they're asking for? But that is, the wine industry has not heard that yet. They're not reacting well to the fact that, as you said, people are changing their attitudes.
I think about when you talk about beer and how that has a better entry point. I mean, I think about when you go to a tap room, you can actually get a flight.
Yes.
You can get smaller pours.
Yes.
Obviously, with wine, there's tasting rooms. Are tasting rooms adapting to be an entry point to potential wine drinkers to kind of steer people away, if they do drink alcohol, to try wine?
Some are, some aren't. So one example, by the way, the one issue I would say, although they're fixing this with things like the Coravin, where you can open up a bottle and stay open for a while. But the thing about beer is that so much of beer is sold out of kegs, or small bottles, but you can pour a whole lot of tastes and it's not a problem. Whereas wine, you open a whole bunch of bottles, you got to pour the rest of those bottles, they're going to go bad maybe in a day. And so that is one of the things. But we were talking just before the show that about two examples, how to do it right, how not to do it right. And some tasting rooms are adjusting. And this is the lesson to the entire industry. So one very nice, well-intentioned Midtown tasting room that folded not so long ago, they were trying to be all natural, and they were trying to be different, and they were trying really hard, and they had tons of enthusiasm, but they didn't know how deep inside the circle of wine culture they were. So they weren't selling well to people. And they had like three-word descriptors. I actually brought a couple. You know, for example, they had only three choices or four choices for a white. And most people would not recognize most of those wines. There were things like Fernão Pires, which is a Portuguese grape, but they had one from South Africa. Why? And the description, Asian pear lemon verbena. I have no idea what that wine is. Is it light? Is it heavy? You know, it's things like that. And they were trying really hard, but it was so, you know, mystic and so out there that you felt like, you know, you needed to get a couple of, you know, a master somm degree, and then you can go and drink their wine. Whereas, and we've talked about them once before when we talked about their sparkly mead, and I love these folks, is Lucid down there on R Street and 10th. Great winemaker, lovely guy. His name is Kevin Luther. I'm shouting out because he does it right. First of all, he's a really good winemaker. Second, he makes all kinds of different wines, including natural wines and some high-end stuff. But they also, the place is set up like a cafe. You know, it's half wine room, half cafe. You can sit there all day and play games and not drink if you want. But they have a trivia night. They have an open mic night. You know, I was posting about that and got a bunch of people said, open mic and wine? Awesome. And that's the thing that wine needs to understand is to make itself friendly. And those kinds of taste rooms, and they're not the only one, but those kinds of taste rooms are what will keep people interested. And then they eventually become either wine enthusiasts or just drink a little. But either way, you know, that's the answer.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of people hang out in groups, and not everyone is into wine. Some people are, but a place that, as you're laying out and helping us visualize, like Lucid, you don't have to be a wine drinker to actually enjoy the vibe, enjoy the environment, enjoy hanging out with your friends there, and then maybe, perhaps, you'll actually end up trying their wine. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with New York Times bestselling author and wine expert here at Insight, Rick Cushman, about the challenges facing California's wine industry. So we're focusing on why people are drinking less, and I imagine that has to have an impact on the agricultural side, production. How are grapevines faring?
Yeah, not well, actually. You know, there are lots of problems in American ag, and a lot of it has to do with interest rates, because interest rates make it very expensive. And, you know, farming at any level, there's always holdover loans and things like that. But when there are fewer people buying your product, then there's less need for it. And the Allied Grape Growers, which is the group that represents California grape growers, suggest that they should pull 50,000 acres worth of grapes, which is a ton of wine. It's, you know, we're talking millions of cases in amount. But it's not just here. In Australia, the government has actually started a panel and inquiry, and they support the wine industry there, but to figure out how to save the industry because they're not selling.
Like a task force.
Yep, the task force. And in Bordeaux. And Bordeaux is the fun thing about Bordeaux, because the French are so passionate, they do everything out in the open. Bordeaux is really showing the problem. The problem is, so the big wine companies they like that there's this glut. The reason it drives the cost down. But if you're a grower, you want to get rid of your vines because otherwise you have to pay to farm those things. And that's really been part of the problem. One of the places that's actually feeling this is our friends in Lodi. And for a couple of reasons, Lodi, they grow a lot of grapes.
The Zinfandel capital of the world.
They kind of are. But they also grow a lot of grapes for a lot of other wines in other regions, including Napa. And the problem is, so those folks aren't getting, you know, they're not selling as much. But the Zin that they grow, a lot of them is what's called head trained, which means that the vine itself is just sitting there. It's not on a wire that you see. So you don't get those really neat lines going down the landscape, which makes wine country look so beautiful. Instead, you have these little bushes.
But is that like old vine Zin?
Yeah, those are old vines for sure. And some less, but usually. And it's one of the ways to grow Zin. And with old vines, you definitely need to be picked by hand, which is very expensive. So you're getting less, you're paying more to farm, and you're fewer people are drinking it, those old vines are at risk.
If you're going to actually pull a grapevine, I mean, is there I know there's a financial impact in that you're not producing and you're not getting money, but is there actually a cost to remove the grapevine?
The estimate averages out about $2,500 an acre. which is not cheap. So now you're stuck if you're a farmer. And, you know, because you have to pull the vine, you have to grind it, you have to get rid of it. Yeah, you have stakes in the ground. If you're going to farm something else there, you got to get those stakes out. You know, there's just a lot of work involved.
Are wine growers, I mean, California's ag industry is diverse. Are they pivoting to other crops?
Some are, and they're growing all kinds of things. One of the things that they're growing in water-stressed areas like Southwest Central Valley is agave. So maybe we're going to, maybe our tequila will
get cheaper. We have had an agave producer who made an agave spirit there in Yolo County.
Yeah, it can't be tequila because it has to be from the tequila region, but an agave spirit. Exactly right. Yeah, and you know, and so there's pistachio trees is another crop because although pistachios need a lot of water eventually to thrive, they also can withstand drought well. So that's, you know, on a bad year, you don't have a crop, but at least you don't lose your plants. So, and those are a couple. And some places are letting it go fallow, and there's all kinds of issues going on.
You know, if you are advising someone, because obviously that trickles up to tasting rooms, actually buying bottles, you know, you want people to be exposed to wine, you want them to enjoy wine if they drink alcohol. How would you advise someone to get people to open up to drinking wine?
So the first thing you do, and this is always hard, this is hard for anybody in any industry, is you got to think about who you are. You know, how deep are you inside the wine world? Think about somebody that you know that knows nothing about wine, and how do you talk to them? And, you know, and make it joyful. Remember, there's no wrong answers. And this is, these questions happen a lot. You know, somebody wants to drink a buttery Chardonnay and people roll their eyes. Look, if somebody wants to drink a buttery Chardonnay, give it to them. If somebody wants to drink a lean Chardonnay, give it to them. Don't make fun of them.
My dad puts an ice cube in his red wine.
And what do we care if you're in the wine business? Because he's drinking wine and he's happy. Why do they have to drink it the way you do? The next thing is, and this is a thing I've been preaching for a long time, and I have science behind me on this, is don't use tasting notes. And certainly when people walk in and you start to pour them a wine, just don't give them flavors. But the Cornell has this school of hotel administration. They do this study somewhat regularly, and they have found that tasting notes hurt sales in little wineries and big wineries. And the reason is because if you describe a wine and people taste it and they don't taste those things, they think the wine must not be for me. So don't tell them, don't describe flavors, but when they come in, ask them about themselves, ask them where they've been, ask them what they like. So if they drink wine, ask them what wines do they like, and then find them. And if you're going to describe your wine, sell the romance of it. Describe the vineyard. Don't tell them about the soil or the trellising. They don't know what whole cluster fermentation is. Just tell them this. It's a really pretty vineyard, and it's up on the hillside. And if it's yours, point to it. If it comes from somebody else, say we have this. You know, whatever it is. You know, because people love wine country. I love wine country, and that's one of the things that that going to wineries are good at selling, which is their sense of place. So sell that. Let folks know where it comes from, and. You know, there's this sense in all food now where we're looking for natural, right? And natural wine's complicated and some places good, not so good. But let people feel the nature of what you're doing and then let them enjoy it and don't tell them they're wrong.
Last 30 seconds, I want to end on a promising note. Why is now spring a great time to try wine?
Because of what you just said, spring is great. But, you know, because the tasting rooms aren't busy. And it's really pretty, and it's getting warm, but plus new wines are coming out. So like the new, this where we're 2024, the 2022 reds and 22 reds are coming out. The whites from last year, which is going to be a great year, are coming out. So there's a lot of new wine to taste, and the rooms aren't busy, and they will be thrilled to see you.
Rick, as always, it's a pleasure.
Always my pleasure.
That is New York Times bestselling author and wine expert Rick Cushman discussing the challenges facing California's wine industry and why now is a perfect time to show tasting rooms a little love. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A Central Valley celebration of Latinx cartoonists, animators, artists, creators is returning to Modesto this weekend. The Latinx Comic Arts Festival seeks to expand educational opportunities and develop programming for Latinos and other underrepresented populations, especially when it comes to the creative arts. Now in its fifth year, the festival returns to Modesto Junior College, which is itself a Hispanic-serving institution with over 50% of the student body identifying as Latinx. The two-day event, which runs tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday, includes dozens of workshops, discussion panels, and even a lowrider exhibit. Dr. Teresa Rojas is the festival's director and also a professor at the college and joins us now with a preview of what people and comic fans can expect. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much, Vicky. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, Professor Rojas, this isn't your first time on Insight talking to us about the Latinx Comic Arts Festival, but can you give us a little bit of history if this is a listener's first time learning about it, how it started and how it's grown?
First of all, I did not expect to be doing year five of the Latinx Comic Arts Festival, so I'm very excited. And it's a great origin story because it begins with just a single cartoonist visiting us back in 2018. Rafael Navarro was our visiting author. And one of the reasons I invited him up is because he has this amazing talent where he draws while he tells stories. And so he can multitask in this way that's just fascinating. It's magical, actually. And we had a public display of this, and he talked about being born in Mexico and growing up in Los Angeles, and just his story of working in comics. And people did not want to leave. The students did not want to leave that evening. And it led to a conversation about what we could do. And we invited the Latino Comics Expo that was created and run by a couple of friends of mine. And I co-directed that event in 2019 here on campus where we hosted it. And it was amazing. It was the most well-attended Latinx-centered event in the history of the college. So that told me something. There was a gap there. There was a need. And so I jumped in. I reached out to my dean, Jillian Daly, and I said, I want to do this comics convention thing. And she said, I don't know exactly what's all involved, but you do it if you want to do it. And it launched from there. But we were ready in 2020 for our first Latinx Comic Arts Festival. March of 2020, the week before, we got shut down. And, you know, the world got shut down. So it was very dramatic, very emotional. But I realized that people were doing things online. So I learned how to use Zoom. I learned how to stream. And we did a very small 4 hours of programming, 4 or 5 hours of programming online. And that went super well. It was well received. We sent out packets of things to students. And we came back in 2021 with a full festival online. It was madness. It was 15 hours of programming, including a walkthrough of a virtual gallery, an art gallery. We had panels. We had pre-recorded things. We had live things. And it was me doing tech support for myself and hosting, so that was crazy. But it was wonderful because we realized that, okay, as soon as we can come back in person, we need to keep, every time I said I was going to take a break, no, we came back in person in 2023. That was our masked year, so we had lots of COVID rules, and still we had tons of people coming out. And so last year,
2022 and 20. You've been in person
21.
Since.
Yeah. Yes, correct. Dang it. I usually tell this story so well. So we had our 2021 was the 15 hours of programming. 2022 was our masked year. Last year, we were back fully in person, full events, lowrider show on Saturday. And that broke attendance records. So that again is the sign that we need to keep going. So yeah. This is year five now, and we have our full programming. We have workshops, panels on Saturday. We have the lowrider exhibit on Saturday, and we have almost 70 exhibitors, so 70 comic arts folks.
That's great. So when it comes to like this being in Modesto, when I think of like, you know, Comic-Con, for example, it's usually like these bigger urban cities. I mean, Modesto is a city, of course. It's a sizable one. It's in the Central Valley. Each place is unique in its own demographic and its advantages. What does a comic arts festival add to a place like Modesto?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because I think it's kind of the reverse for me. What does Modesto add to a comics convention is the way I look at it, because I've been here for 8 years now, and what I've realized is that Modesto is very artful. It's extremely artful. We've got a growing mural community. We've got all kinds of really cool arts going on. And so this is a way to invest in this sort of intersection of comics creation and the community. So there's a hunger for it. And so here it is. And it's a very diverse event that lets folks see our students and our community see their own faces reflected in the creators.
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of industries, but also when you're looking at comic books, I mean, it has also received some, you know, just historically, you know, it's mostly white or male, you know, straight characters, and that has changed in recent years as well. That is evolving. And this Latinx Comic Arts Festival is part of that evolution and part of that change. A big piece of this are attracting people to be part of this exhibit. How do you attract people to come to Modesto and, you know, have them feel comfortable and welcome and so that they have a fun time so they'll want to come back next year?
That's a very important part of what we do. So it's a curated show, which means that we don't just put a general call out. We call back our former exhibitors and see who's interested in coming back. And we kind of listen to see what the response is to different creators. We see what the openings are. But I do a lot of outreach when I go to Comic-Con. I go to the big ones and I talk about Modesto. And what's been happening is that I went to San Diego, for example, and LA Comic-Con this year, introduce myself, and they say, oh, you're the person who puts on the Modesto show. And I'm just like, how do you know the Modesto show? So what we're doing is we're cultivating this really positive energy. We're taking care of our exhibitors, which is not something that happens everywhere. And we're in a college, so our students are doing assignments that are related to comic arts and such. So our exhibitors get questions that are at a higher level. They have deeper conversations about their work. And so word spreads quickly that this is happening in Modesto. And so folks want to come here. I'm at the point where people are mad at me now because they're, you know, we don't have enough space. We have a very limited area. And so I think that's a great problem to have.
Yeah, you're the cool group. People want to be part of the Latinx Comic Arts Festival. In the last, you know, minute or so that we have in the show, if this is someone's first time, they're going to be heading down there. They want to take it all in Friday and Saturday. How do you recommend they do so?
They need to come on Friday and take a survey of everything. That's the slower day when there are more conversations happening. Longer conversations are possible, and then bring your friends and family and everybody else that you can gather for Saturday for the car show, for an expanded version of the thing. And, you know, just come and have a good time and make sure to look around the whole space. Just really take it in and enjoy what you're seeing. Everyone's very friendly and extremely welcoming, and we are looking forward to welcoming everyone to Modesto this weekend.
And it's open to all ages?
All ages. It's absolutely free. It's family friendly. And so there are free parking even. I can't say free enough. So we want to create, you know, access, as much access as possible. And also to welcome folks to a college campus. For some people, it'll be the first time they've ever set foot on a college campus. So come and find me. Talk to me. I'm happy to talk about comics. I'm happy to talk about college. I teach ethnic studies and English.
Well, Teresa, as always, thank you for joining us. I'm happy what started as a little spark, you know, 5 or 6 years ago has manifested into a full-on comic arts festival that goes well beyond Modesto.
Thank you. And Vicky, I appreciate the work that you do so much. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And I really appreciate that as well. Dr. Teresa Rojas is a professor at Modesto Junior College and the director of the Latinx Comic Arts Festival. The event is in its fifth year and it returns to the college tomorrow, Friday, as well as on Saturday. We have more information on our Insight page, of course. And that is it for Insight today. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.